Welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health Science and Energy Show. And this will be July 17th, 2011. So we're going to have a nice show here today, and I hope you all enjoy it. And with that said, we're going to fire this puppy up and see what goes on here. A lot going on, actually. Start off with a little music.
And my guest tonight, Dr. Fred Bell. Dr. Bell has authored many books. His latest, Rays of Truth, Crystals of Light. We'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Fred Bell is the author of many books, most recently a bestseller called Rays of Truth, Crystals of Light. He's a former NASA scientist, and he worked with the late Wernher von Braun. He was a consultant to more than 3,000 high-tech companies before he started Paradigm. Today, although he is in celebrity management and the film industry now, he still runs the company Paradigm and still has governmental ties as well. At age 14, by the way, he went to work for the government on a project called MKUltra. You heard of that. And Dr. Bell is also a musician, music and film producer as well. He believes in music and imagery and gets the word out very quickly, and he's also very much involved in project awareness, and he is my guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, Fred. How are you, Doctor?
George, it's a real pleasure to be on your show finally. I've listened to it many times, especially when Sean Morton's been on there, and it's a true pleasure to talk to you finally, one-on-one here.
Likewise, me too, and you come so highly recommended, Dr. Bell. I'm glad, too. And no relation to art, right?
I don't know. I don't know what we are. I mean, possibly we're cousins or something.
Really?
I don't know. I am a direct descendant of Alexander Graham Bell, and my crazy dad brought the London Bridge over, and that's about, crazy. Art living up there in Pahrumpsa has got to be part of the family somewhere. I'm sure we could plug him in.
That's good. I saw your name.
Yeah.
And I've known about you for so many years. I said, I wonder if they're related.
Art would probably be embarrassed because I'm too crazy. He's a little crazy. I'm way out there. You know? He wouldn't admit it if he knew anyway.
Talking about crazy, is it true? I've got to ask you this.
Yeah.
Do you live on top of an inactive volcano?
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, I'd like to give you the name of the strata because it's really strange that we had a eucalyptus tree blow over about 10 years ago, and we found gold nuggets. It's 3 ounces per ton. Then the guy across the street built a house and dug a basement. He had the same vein. I have a huge gold mine or vein going under my house, and that's very true. And I apologize for not remembering the exact name of the phenomenon of the volcano that I live on, but there's a huge vortex up here. And I started my book, Rays of Truth, with pictures of it. And some amazing things have happened over the years here. It really is. It's constantly happening, actually.
Aren't you afraid that this inactive volcano is going to pop one day?
No, it's not really, because the type of volcano that it is, it produces a strata, and it's like turned into quartz and gold. It goes way down, and it wouldn't. It would blow sideways and go next to us. You know what I mean? It's like really plugged up.
I mean, is there a hole though?
Yeah.
Underneath you?
Yeah. There's not a hole. It's full of quartz and. When you get down to the beach and the rocks below, you can see the actual lava pieces, but not really a hole. It's like quartz. The material has turned into quartz. I'm sure some of the geologists out there that might call him later something would know. But there is a particular name for this type of volcano. There's actually 3 of them in Laguna Beach, and I'm on the center one.
What did your insurance company ever have to say about that?
They don't even know.
They do now.
Yeah, there you go. No, I don't think they worry about it too much. And it's kind of neat with earthquakes because it kind of absorbs. We've had a lot of earthquakes up here, you know, over the years.
You were on a little less than a year ago with Barbara Simpson.
Yeah, I was.
Had an opportunity. You have had a very different career.
Right.
Tell me, I want to go back just a little bit because
sure.
The weekday audience hasn't had an opportunity
to
share
right.
with you.
That's great.
Tell me about the Project MK Ultra and how you, at an age of 14, got involved
okay,
with
it. Okay, did you watch that miniseries Taken on the Sci-Fi
show? Oh, absolutely.
Okay, the Jesse and Jacob section was taken off of my life. I was born on the second marriage. My mother and dad divorced and remarried. And that was kind of strange. And he worked for Henry Ford, and Norman Miller delivered me. So Norman Miller, in those days, in 1943 when I was born, you know, the doctors were like rock stars. Dr. Shumway, for example, did the first heart transplant. It was like a rock star in those days. So he delivered me. So that put me in a high profile. My dad was pretty well known. He was an alumni at the University of Michigan. And I started working with a guy from Operation Paperclip, being, you know, with the transference of the Nazi people coming over and going to work for us.
Right.
With Dr. Katz. And I worked in the Randolph Laboratory at the University of Michigan, and any of the old alumni out there listening will know that's very true. That existed. They tore the building down. Four levels down on the cyclotron and synchrotron projects. This is back a long time ago. I was just a kid. And I was working on these projects. And we got into, we were charging and discharging capacitors, I didn't know what the project we were working on at the time was, but later on it was called the Philadelphia Experiment. But what we were doing is we were doing these coils and exploding coils and all kinds of strange things. It was really way out for me, but it wasn't called the Philadelphia Experiment. Well, Stephen Eberbaugh and I, we were kind of like one-on-one. We were the same major, about 10 years old. His dad owned Eberbaugh Pharmacy, which is all over the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started hooking oscilloscopes up to our brain, and we built our own oscilloscopes, and we had, and that's an instrument for looking at waveforms, in case people out there don't know. And then we hooked up to our brain signal generators, and we started doing pulsing, and we started doing past life regressions and all this kind of thing.
It's funny you bring that up. I'm going to ask you a little bit about time travel and something that I'm going to go through in a few weeks. I'll bring that up a little later on.
Sure.
But at the age you were in, I mean, were they bringing you in? Was your father bringing you in just you could just play around? Or
no, no. I had a TV repair business. You know, I was 9 years old. I was repairing televisions. I still had tubes. I was just one of these kind of kids that started like at age four playing around with stuff.
You must have been a boy genius or something.
Well, I don't know. I was just different. You know, they used to call me Ding Dong, you know, because I was Bell, you know, and the word nerd hadn't been invented yet. You know, but I had a lot of strange titles, but I was just really adamant to do this stuff, and I started hanging out there with Dr. Katz, and they suddenly realized that I had some talent, Stevie did. And pretty soon, I sort of got involved with the CIA. You know, they came in, they sort of gave me a secret clearance. They did a background check, but they already knew my dad, because he was, you know, worked for the government before. So suddenly I had this clearance, and I was like getting into bigger projects and bigger projects.
I mean, did you get paid for all this?
No. I was a student. At 15 years old, then I had to sign some papers, and then I went into the Air Force when I was like 15 and a half, but I couldn't go anywhere because you had to be 17 to be legally there. So what they did is they billeted me for a little while. So I guess I got paid in the fact that I got to live down in Little Rock, Arkansas, and hang out with the people at a biolab down there and live in a motel, which is paid for, and see all this strange stuff until I was, you know, old enough to actually officially go in. So I had a kind of a strange life with all of this.
It's almost like you didn't have a childhood, though.
I didn't.
No.
I didn't. I'm just now having it.
You're doing a reversal.
Airplanes hanging everywhere, and young kids come over here and they freak out because I'm into trains and planes. And you know, I'm a pilot. I fly helicopters and regular planes, but I have over 200 of those mahogany, Philippines. They make them down there. Those models of I've got World War II and World War I and every kind of plane hanging here because I'm just a plane freak, you know, on top of everything else. I guess I collect too many things, but. You know, it's all in good taste.
Nothing wrong with that, Fred.
No.
Nothing wrong with that. So at that young age, I mean, you have, like, jump-started your life into technology and some other things. At what point in your life didn't you also start coming across some very strange things?
Well, let me tell you something. I went to a lot of, when you mentioned those 3,000 companies, and I've been working with Dr. Stephen Greer on the Disclosure Project, and
yes.
I had to Xerox a bunch of my journals and give them to the Senate. To prove that I really did all this stuff. Because I go into IBM in East Fishkill and I'd meet the president, the head engineering guy, and then there'd be five different engineering projects, and I'd deal with the project engineer, the different engineers all the way down the line. I documented all this. I had these big, thick books, fat, full of projects. So this happened when I was in my early 20s, I left NASA in 1966. It was right after that. And I got to go to all these projects. I used to go to Langley and Quantico and in Amarillo, Texas. One day I gave a lecture underground on a bunker with my head on a nuclear warhead, my foot rather standing on it. Because they had they used to have nurse made these things, and we had equipment that allowed to monitor temperature and battery condition, because these warheads are alive, And I did all this crazy stuff, so I got to go to all these strange places. I never went inside Area 51, but I used to go to EG&G up there in Nevada, and EG&G is where the plane would take off, carrying everybody to Area 51.
Okay.
EG&G is one of my clients, so up there in Las Vegas.
Sure.
I really did see a lot of stuff, and a lot of things that people really wouldn't believe. I mean, I spent a lot of time in Bell Telephone in Murray Hill, New Jersey, and a lot of stuff going on there that was really interesting. It was all highly classified, and some of the stuff I really never talked about ever, because nobody would believe what was going on. And the reason I got into all these places is because I was in instrumentation. I've been trained over in Colorado, in Boulder, at the United States Metrology Center, where you calibrate oscilloscopes and signal generators and strain gauges for measuring, changes on wings and wind tunnels.
Right.
All this stuff. So I had all this background and all this instrumentation about everything that there was. So if you had a experiment going on anywhere in the world, you needed to make quantitative and qualitative analysis. You needed Dr. Fred. Of course, I wasn't Dr. Fred then. I was just Fred Bell. And it was really funny. I got so good at this, and it was so much in demand. And I used to be, there was a thing called electronic news. It was like the local paper that came out once a week. I used to wear a Confederate war outfit going into all these companies. I wouldn't wear a suit. I was a complete radical, and they just loved me for that because I was so different, but I was knowledgeable. So I always kind of like stuck out. Everybody else had short hair. I had to have long hair, not real long, but
right. Longer.
So I was kind of a radical. I still have photographs and articles of all this, and that was just like in demand all over the place because they really wanted somebody crazy. I just kind of, made, when you go into a dull engineering lab where everything's kind of like day in, day out, same routine, and this crazy guy comes in a Confederate war outfit, not a full-on dress uniform, but pretty much along those lines, no sword or anything, but the jacket and the pants, and start showing them how to make stuff happen. They just love you for it. So I sort of had a little comic act going with my technology trip.
Well, most geniuses are a little eccentric, aren't they?
I was totally, totally whacked out. But, it worked. I made a good buddy out of it. People still remember me. It's really amazing. Mm-hmm. Even though I'm in kind of like the New Age field now, I did make a very strong cross in the Orthodox field. I spent a lot of time over at CRW and a lot of time over at Hughes. My dad used to work with Howard Hughes, but I'd never met him. My dad knew him really well. I met Gordon Bow, who was, when Hughes was doing his RKO thing, he used to take all these girls, like 13, 14 women, dress them up, take them out late at night, the wannabes, to be the actresses.
Oh, sure.
And my friend Gordon Bow, who invented roll-on mascara for Revlon, a dear friend of mine up until a few years ago when he left the planet, but he used to tell me all the stories of how he used to doll up Howard Hughes' things. And then Bob McCulloch and my dad were close. They brought the London Bridge over, and we call it then Site 6, but it became Havasu City. And there was Bob Tishman, who built half the buildings in L.A. So I kind of, as a kid, grew up with the heavy, the shakers and movers.
Yeah, you were right in it. So, I mean, were these guys the Illuminati, Fred?
No, not these. These guys were hardheads. My dad, he's still alive. He's 90, and he had a stroke. And I called him up the other day, and he's like, I hadn't talked to him in a while. I says, Dad, how are you doing? Gotta go, meaning he wants to check out.
Yeah.
I says, Dad, I'd like to come and see you. No visitors. That's the way these guys were. And he's like the last of the Mohicans.
Yeah.
No, the Illuminati was another group. That was another group, more so within, I had some friends that worked along those lines.
But you must have touched their lives somehow.
Oh, I did.
Yeah.
I did. The Bilderberger family, and I'm just trying to... A lot of the German families I worked with that did this stuff. Some of them worked up there at Los Alamos. I used to go to Los Alamos, like, daily. I mean, that was such a... I was so in and out of that place. Because, before it became known as it is now, nobody knew what it was then. Like Oak Ridge, I went there in Tennessee. But when they were, they were splitting the atom down there and making, nuclear... fuel for nuclear reactors and stuff a long time ago.
Were you like a consultant on a lot of these projects,
Fred? Yeah, I was a consultant on all of them because my job was instrumentation, but that didn't mean that I wouldn't have to take a project full term, meaning that as they would go along in their work, I might have to... when I was working, you know, I was a rep on top of that, a rep. I worked a lot with EH Research, and we did a lot of... EH Research was up in Oakland. They were one of my companies. I actually became vice president there at one point, but before I was one of their reps. And we were out at ENG&G. They'd be making these high-speed measurements, electromagnetic pulse stuff that you hear about, and this way-out stuff. And we had to develop transformers and oscilloscopes to work to see what they were doing. So I had to consult with manufacturing companies like Tektronix. Howard Ballard was a friend of mine. That's a big company. Iwatsu was an oscilloscope company. I worked with Hewlett-Packard, not only as a client, but development on their oscilloscope line over there up in Palo Alto on Page Mill Road. So I worked with all these companies. So I was like talking to the manufacturers saying, this project coming down the stream from, say, over here at AT&T, they're coming down the road with this project. We're going to have to take our existing equipment and make it kind of like adapt for that project.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that would make a new model for something. You follow me?
Yes.
So therefore, I was consulting. I mean, if you look at it that way.
Were these government projects?
No, not all. Like when I worked at Lockheed and Boeing and Douglas, these were, you know, this was commercial, you know, and then, you know, airplanes. And then, but then there was a lot of government. About, I'd say 70% of what I do was government somehow or other, you know. It really was.
All right, somewhere in your career,
yeah,
you came across the belief that there's life out there. Tell me, how did Stephen Greer get you involved in Disclosure?
That's a good question. Actually, because of free energy, I think, is where we really hooked up.
Okay.
And I was working with a friend of mine named Norm Hayes, who lives down in Springfield, Missouri now. And he worked on a lot of stuff. And he was working over at Davis. And when I first met him, and he developed the idea of taking an electrolytic capacitor, and a capacitor has, these electrolytics have like a material in them that stores electricity. Well, they found out during the moon shifts and phases of the moon and phases of the planets going around the sun that the surface tension of these materials would change, causing electrical charge. And so he made a micro. He was in the. I was working up with a couple of companies with what's called thin film technology at the time, and what we were doing is working on what are called masks. Masks are a process to make integrated circuits, so we could put like 10,000 transistors on something a few microns across. Well, I was involved in the development of that technology, and so using that technology, we made these capacitors, and these capacitors produced electricity that kept these liquid crystal things alive. Because if a liquid crystal device, when they first came out, if it lost electricity, like it was a battery-powered watch, but it had that display in it,
mm-hmm,
if the battery went off, the whole crystal would never come back to life again.
So you'd lose everything.
So we had these little capacitors that we made, and we put them in there, so if the battery quit, the capacitor kept the thing going, and it was like perpetual motion.
Right,
left,
right.
But it produced a few nanoamps. It was all necessary to illuminate the readout, you know what I mean?
That's exciting.
It was so many things, you know, so trippy, you know.
Well, you seem to have focused in on something now.
Yeah, I'm totally focused on something now, shape energy, yeah.
What is that?
Well, shape energy is, for example, you know, what is the shape of the red blood cell in your body? That's very important to know, because if it's not shaped properly, it cannot carry oxygen to your cells to bring up carbon dioxide. You know, the shape of the red blood cell is an octahedron. You know, it's a four-sided pyramid repeated one up, one down, one upside down, one right side up, with a 52-degree angle slant, and it's made out of iron in your body. If you breathe in carbon monoxide or poison, it disrupts the geometry of that particular pyramid, and what happens is it cannot any longer function as a vehicle to bring in oxygen, the life force, into the body.
Is the shape critical to its
totally
performance?
So critical. It is so critical. It is so critical. Anytime you have space and time and you put a shape in there and you have a magnetic field nearby and you put a shape in there, that shape of that energy augmentates that magnetic field. And if you take people, for example, out of the Earth's magnetic field and put them out in space, like orbiting the planet,
yeah,
they can't assimilate calcium and they'll have heart problems. That's the astronaut problem. I worked in space medicine, too. So shape energy is so critical. What's a bad shape? A bad shape would be an isometric tetrahedron, like
all right,
a virus.
Hold that thought for a second, Fred. I'll be back with you. I want to talk more with you about this shape energy. I mean, this is incredible. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment with my guest tonight, Dr. Fred Bell on Coast to Coast AM.
Subscribe to the After Dark newsletter and reserve your free CD of Art Bell and the late Father Malachi Martin. 888-727-5505. Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, Dr. Fred Bell's website is Paradyne.com. Let me spell it for you. It's linked up already with coasttocoastam.com. PYRADYNE.com. His book, Rays of Truth, Crystals of Light. We'll come back and talk with him about shapes and how it affects energy. That's just one of the things we're going to chat with him about on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Dr. Fred Bell, my guest. Fred, last hour, at the top of the hour, I had a story about how some scientists have frozen a beam of light only for 10 to 20 microseconds. But what they did is something that I think you'll find of interest because you've done some work in this arena. They had something to do with, through the whole testing procedure, they created what was called a holographic imprint of the signal pulse on atoms. And aren't you involved in some kind of technology like that?
The projector technology, which is part of the receptor technology, is holograms. And I'm very involved in that. I've been doing that for quite a while. That's when you start looking at... We look at holograms as wave packets. And you have to go through an analogy... to keep it in lay terms, of energy following thought. And with the Tibetan teachers, they used to say the mind is the slayer of the real, so keep the mind out of it and realize energy follows thought. And that the first thing you have to understand is how scalar waves work and where they come from and how they fit in the universe. And I've seen so many lame theories about what scalar waves are. And in my book, Rays of Truth, I go into the way that the holographic effect of an electron and a proton, an example of a hydrogen atom, you know, we're made up of water, H2O. But a hydrogen atom, people think of the hydrogen atom as a proton and an electron, the proton being 1,645 times more dense of energy than the electron.
Mm-hmm.
The electron moves around the proton at the speed of light. Well, bottom line is, the electron does move around the proton at the speed of light, but it doesn't go continuously. It stops. It stops and vibrates. And then it moves around and stops and vibrates, and it doesn't go in an orbit. It goes in a figure eight or a bow tie or whatever, and these are called PS W orbital. So it goes in, and depending on what the hydrogen atom is applied to, determines its orbital pattern, and determining how the electron vibrates determines the energy that's coming down from higher planes. Well, what energy? Well, we break that energy down into hadrons and quarks. Quarks, strangely enough, start to show up when the electron stops for something less than, if you're going close to, speed of light, 186,273 miles per second, and you stop whatever that object is, there's a tremendous inertia to stop it and start it again. It does it many times as it rotates around. And so this shakes loose a higher energy with these quarks, which within their hadrons, which in their leptons. Leptons, of course, affect gravity, they create gravity waves. But when you go back to the quarks, science got into studying the quarks quite a while ago, and I spent a lot of time in nuclear physics, and the quarks, science began to observe them in a laboratory, and science, as they observed them, began to notice that there were behavioral capabilities of these things, and so they started to name these quarks up, down, strangeness, charm, beauty. These names are like psychological names.
Yeah.
Okay? And this happened a long time ago. And there's a book by, I forget, Stephen, somebody, is the extrasensory perception of quarks. And this is where, by understanding how these things behave, because they would work with our brain waves in certain kind of scientific experiments, a lot of times scientists would challenge themselves on the results of the same experiment because they had different thought patterns moving into this. And so this also goes up on the edge of what scalar waves are and how scalar waves work. And then when you go from quarks, within quarks are hadrons, within hadrons are leptons. And when you get to the lepton level, realize all these things are, there's this interchange of this electron that's stopping and starting millions of times going the speed of light around the hydrogen. The energy gets more and more and more intense. It becomes huge. So
even at that minuscule size.
Oh, my God. Yeah, because remember, if you look at the Big Bang, the whole thing started in something smaller than an electron,
uh-huh.
The whole universe.
Uh-huh.
But when you the way I really got a handle on this was studying the Tibetan science, the holy science that was in the Vedas. I mean, I've had some strange background in science, not just orthodox, but unorthodox. And you really start to learn how energy behaves and human consciousness. And you know what's really funny? If you realize that our bodies are made up of oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, and carbon, okay?
Right.
Oxygen is prana, the animation factor. Nitrogen is protein. It makes dynamite or our body tissue. Hydrogen is consciousness. And the carbon atom is shape energy. We talked about that. The carbon atom is octahedron, like the red blood cell in the body, is shape energy, which organizes everything and makes it all work properly. And when you get into the nitrogen atom, now going into the nitrogen atom, which isn't consciousness, the nitrogen atom forms in the body from trace minerals to enzymes to protein. The proteins then form together, forming hormones. And the hormone you could classify as the first unit of biochemistry that possesses consciousness. And then the hormone, there are seven levels of consciousness. So there's seven sets of hormones and seven endocrine glands, one for each level. And when the hormone goes up to the brain, it causes a synaptic pattern to exchange electromagnetic fields across the brain, which then sends down through the central nervous system, the spinal cord, which has 72,000 major conduits in it, the auric field of the body. And so if you start seeing this, how this works, you begin to understand, the electromagnetic principles of the body. And what's really unique is that when people, psychology-wise or living-wise, do bad things to their body, like put drugs or smoke or do alcohol or argue or fight. Okay, it creates protein deficiencies, hormonal deficiencies in the body. Well, Chinese Ayurvedic medicine goes into these different deficiencies on certain kinds of herbs that go, into the body. If you look at the atomic structure of an herb, if you look at the atomic structure of quarks and hadrons and these non-magnetic particles, you were talking non-magnetic particles, you start to see an influence between this non-magnetic particle behavior and the actual biochemical structure of certain kinds of herbs. So if you look at a failure in the system of the hydrogen atom, which is consciousness, which is also causing a failure of nitrogen in the system, which means protein and hormone deficiency, you can plug that diminished capacity to an extra capacity of, that, of an herb and plug that herb into a particular situation, and that becomes the whole science of herbal Ayurvedic medicine, where you take a plant and you plug it into an electromagnetic structure and it feeds it. So you begin to see, when you start to see these kinds of things, how this stuff works, you begin to understand the overall scheme of how things work.
Old Chinese herbalists were probably using herbs to solve all kinds of things, but never really understood the science behind it.
Right. There was always a gap between the electromagnetic and beyond and the other thing. Okay, so this, we sort of got off the holographic thing, but this is one thing that goes on. Now, the mechanizing force behind that of the combination of what we're talking about starts to form the hologram. And this is where you start getting into energy follows thought. Because these we're talking on an atomic level, and then we go up to a thought form level, which organizes the atomic structure. Because you're talking about freezing light, you know, stopping light.
Mm-hmm.
And light is only a light is a photon. A photon is a animating factor of illumination or reflection. It's total darkness from the astral plane. If you were to go to the astral plane, you like these faster than light spaceships do that we all read about, everything is self-illuminating. They don't have a sun there. Everything illuminated, it glows within itself.
Exactly.
Okay?
Exactly.
When you come down here to the physical plane, it's all dark. So it's a constant bunch of reflections that go on. Certain frequencies makes light waves, you know. Certain frequencies lower makes sound waves. And it starts to vibrate, and it starts to build up a homogeneous structure that appears to us illusionary as a world, as people, and blah, blah, blah. I mean, color is not color. Color is only a reflection of light, perceived as a color.
That's all it is.
Yeah. And then when you start looking at the synapses in the brain, because I used to say, people used to ask me, well, somebody saw a spaceship fly by. Well, I didn't see it. Well, guess what? Your synapses were not fast enough to perceive the light that this thing was emanating. So you have to start speeding up your synaptic frequency.
Good point.
Yeah, to make it work. And same with sound. You know, people are tone deaf. Well, you're nobody's tone deaf. You just haven't exercised those muscles and neurons in your body to make you perceptive of a tone. You know, that's kind of how the whole body works. So, it's you know, one thing I learned about life is that you got to, when these physical bodies, you got to work every aspect of it that you can think of, you know?
Well, when you were talking about the shape energy, good
yeah.
and bad shape energy, what is bad shape energy?
Bad shape energy is like a virus, you know. You know, viruses are isometric tetrahedrons, being that they're not equal on all three sides, because the tetrahedron is like draw a line and make a triangle, but one side is wrong. And what happens is when you have those kinds of shapes, the reflection of natural light and natural sound and natural color becomes diffracted. It becomes diffused and self-canceling. It produces what are called standing waves. And if you start putting standing waves, electromagnetic standing waves into the body, you start the destruction of the cellular structure. Because human DNA works at about 375 to 425 megahertz, works on a sinusoidal waveform based on true geometry of sugars and phosphates, which makes up the DNA itself, made up basically of hydrogen atoms, and which are carbon atoms, which are octahedrons.
So let's say when your white blood cells try to fight off infection,
right.
Are they really trying to change the shape?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, because you have, remember this, you have an electromagnetic field on the body, okay?
Sure.
Take that away, you're gone. You're not in your body anymore. Because the cells, like for example, when I do a lot of work with cancer, more than I even want to admit. When we work with cancer, what we do, one of the first things we look at is the charge between the proton, the nucleus of the cell, and the outside part, the electron of the cell. And we like at NASA, we did experiments. We would do negative ionization. I embedded a lot of negative ionizers. They're all over the world now. I was one of the first people to invent those things. We would actually put a needle into a cancer cell and get rid of it. But as we got more and more into what we were doing, we found out that between the positive charge and the negative charge of the cell is a layer of fat. And by getting into oils like omega-3 and these different oils and regulating the insulation barriers, we were able to have a much better control of cancer. So insulation became an oil. Fats and oils in the body became such a strong thing in cancer.
So it's interesting, though, that you approached cancer, you approached this horrible disease
right.
as a under physics as opposed to medicine.
Right, exactly. And then, first as electronics, you know, and then as insulators. Well, what insulates in the body is fat. I mean, you get ringing of the ears, that's tinnitus. Why? Because you have little wires going around in your body, and there's little fat tissue around them, you know. And if you get stressed out, that fat tissue burns off. So what happens is this one little wire and this other little wire start electromagnetically having a little interchange where they really shouldn't see each other. They should be insulated, like the power cord when you plug in your toaster.
Well, it's like losing the coating of a wire or something.
Exactly, exactly. And that's called a myelin sheath in the body.
Yes.
And coconut or lecithin are good things to put in your body, which now, here we go, lecithin's an oil. Once again, putting those things fat. Same thing with synovial degeneration, you know, where your joints start getting... That's the oils are going out. You know, when people start to come down with a cold, for example, I always tell them, don't take vitamin C right away. It's an acid. If your body's already acidic, you got to alkalize your body. You know, so you take chromium picolinate, a mineral, and vitamin E. And then when you alkalinize your body, then go to your vitamin C. People just don't understand. Like, it's all about charges and pH balance and common sense. And when you're dealing with pH, potential hydrogen, you're dealing with the body's oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, carbon. Hydrogen atom is consciousness.
Now, is this theory the same throughout the universe?
What?
It's not only does it apply for the body, not only does it apply just about in every place. I mean, does it apply in everything throughout this universe? It's all the same?
Well, it's pretty much, there's a certain set of physics. You know, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, carbon has to do with all life forms that are human or animal like that. You know, I mean, that applies definitely. It's three gases in a solid pretty much makes up the whole universe. I mean, we look at the sun, what are we looking at? Well, we're looking at helium and hydrogen. It's a little bit of difference there, but we're still looking at hydrogen. Hydrogen is consciousness. When the sun has sunspots, those sunspots are caused by the magnetic field, which is a summation of the earth, of the humans living on it, belching back, usually during a full moon, this negative energy we create over here, which then hits the sun, ruptures its energy, and throws out these flares out, and we just come through a period of that of a million miles or more. Humans, you know, have an effect on the sun. The sun also then has an effect on humans, but we're the ones that cause it first. Because if you look at the sun, and then Mercury, and then Venus, and then the Earth, and then Mars, and all the planets in their orbit, and you look at the field, the field that screwed up the boats is a field coming off the Earth. Because the Earth's field, the etheric field, which also has to do with the Van Allen radiation belt and how it behaves, is made up of all the human beings that are living on it. All these electromagnetic human beings induce fields. You get 8 billion people inducing a field that goes down into the field of the Earth. It has to do with volcanoes, has to do with all kinds of things. The full moon, new moon, full moon creates changes in surface tension on the body. If that's changing, if you're in Turkey and you commit a law, for example, in Istanbul, you'll have a greater leniency for committing a crime during the full moon. This is old stuff that goes into our history and our science of human behavior versus esoteric and planetary behavior versus solar behavior. I wrote about this in my book, all this stuff, by the way. You got a copy of it.
Oh, it's sitting right here.
Yeah.
Sitting
yeah.
right. Did you have some help with this kind of knowledge?
Oh, yeah, totally. Are you kidding?
Where'd it come from?
Well, that was, I don't know, well, past lives, you could say, it gives me a support vehicle. It's one thing, you really can't read a book unless you have to kind of like read between the lines, and you can't really write one unless you kind of write between the lines. When I became a contactee after leaving NASA, I was educated by the Pleiadian people.
That's what I want to talk with you about next hour, how that all happened. I mean, did you approach Jim or did they approach you?
They approached me, but I sensed them because I had my first experience with the Greys, which I'm not real proud of, when I was 6 years old. As a matter of fact, I was emailing a picture of a friend of mine. I took a Polaroid picture in front of my grandparents' house back when I was 30, and there's this white cross that kind of formed above my head, and that's the house that I met this Gray. That's kind of like when I was 6 years old, this Gray came into this house, and I actually met him, a little 3-foot-tall extraterrestrial, which is negative. It freaked me out. But that was my first contact, which then led to the Pleiadians, you know, which occurred back in 1971 when all that started.
You do not like the Grays?
No.
Why not?
Because they are, imagine an insect, their hive consciousness, okay?
Yeah.
Hive consciousness. imagine an insect with a billion years of evolution on it, and that's pretty much what a gray is. They don't have a functioning. I know you know a lot about this because a lot of your speakers go on there.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually met them. You know, I work with people that have worked with them out at Area 51. I've had close encounters with them up in Dulce, New Mexico with the Hickory Apaches. I have been around them half my life. I've seen what they can do. I've been up there to Dulce, which was it has 2,500 Apaches living up there, and I have seen the tribe, how the kids on Saturday night won't go out because they've been abducted by these grays. And I picked one night, I was out in the middle of nowhere, I was doing some work up in Dulce, and these kids were just screaming their heads off because they had a fight, and their boyfriends dropped the girls off, and they were afraid these grays were getting them. I put them in the back of my pickup truck and hauled them back into the central part of Dulce. They wouldn't even go up there on a Saturday night out in the hills because they get abducted. It was so bad. I took Sean up there. We did a film shooting on this back in the mid-'80s, and he got to see it, you know, firsthand.
But right.
That's not the right feeling from an extraterrestrial source. I don't care how enlightened they are or what Taken, you know, projected with Steven Spielberg. I don't like the grays.
When we come back, Fred, I want to ask you a little bit more about those grays and if they are abducting, why they are doing that. And then also find out a little bit more about this help that you got to come up with this really incredible knowledge. Is knowledge about energy. Rays of truth, crystals of light. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment, right after the top of the hour on Coast to Coast AM.
Designed to enlighten me. When I told him that I'm doing fine, watching shadows on the wall. Don't you miss the big time.
To access the audio archives of Coast to Coast AM, log on to coasttocoastam.com.
I'm just sitting here watching the wheels go round and round.
Fast forward the tape to the end and turn it over for the next hour.
Well, that was a pretty good interview there. We're just waiting for the tape to go over to the other side. This was done back in 2003. When we were promoting the Inside or the Rays of Truth, Crystals of Light book, which is great. And now, of course, we got the new Inside track available. So I'm checking to see what's going on here. And we'll just flip it. We will flip it and rewind it. Do, 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 do. How far are we going to rewind it, though? There we go. Now let's see what happens. Hit the reset button. I like to do my editing on the air. It's always fun. See if we got juice on the other side of this. There we go. Love the music. Kind of lightens things up in between these intense talks.
Here comes a situation.
Coast AM with George AM with George Norrie.
And my guest tonight is Dr. Fred Bell. We're talking about his book, Rays of Truth, Crystals of Light. And there's something truly remarkable behind all of this. We'll be back with him in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Fred Bell, my guest. I'm George Norrie. Fred, we were talking about the grays, and you do not like them. There's got to be a reason behind that, huh?
Well, it's because of what I've seen, you know, my tours around the world and what they have done to people. And, you know, when those first ships crashed over there at...
Roswell.
We were working on... Actually, it wasn't me working on it, but what caused those ships to come down was that we were working on a radar, an AFPS-35, which ended up, strangely, at Montauk in the 776 radar squadron, where I was in the northern in Point Arena. And they had a plutonium-type reactor on those ships, which brought them down. They actually, when the reactors reached critical mass, it actually fried the grays. So when the ship hit the ground, the grays were pretty much dead. But the first ship that Jesse Marcel found was a small one. Later on that night, they found a much bigger ship, and it had a lot of human body parts in it.
Human body parts.
Yeah, human body parts. And that's when they decided to get it really highly classified. And I have some friends of mine that I worked with from NASA, a Rockwell team that went up there, that was on the investigation process to figure out how old these things were. They were averaged between 200 and 400 years old, the grays. But that's what really set the thing off, was the human body parts. And then you know, human abductions per se kind of stopped like about 1976, as far as our history went up. You know, when you look at abductions and mutilations, but with sheep and cattle, it continued on even to the present day. So you have to look all the way across the scope of all these mutilations and things, and you start looking at the milk cartons, you know, with missing children on them. And in the old days, we figured about 25% of those missing kids were abducted and probably used for, you know, some of them were kept alive and some of them were killed and used, you know, with a hydrogen peroxide solution that they actually feed on. So if you get into it to the level that I got into it, you don't like them. A lot of people out there probably heard some of this stuff. I only speak from personal experience. I mean, I hear all kinds of crazy theories about extraterrestrials. That's fine. They're not my stuff is not theories. It's real life experience, and there's usually a pretty good bunch of people have been around me to witness some of the things that I'm talking about.
So as far as the Grays are concerned, what's their true agenda here then?
Well, I asked Sinyasi this a long time ago, and she said that they're scavengers. They're energy scavengers is what they are. They were insects originally anyway. And remember, Betty and Barney Hill was like the first bunch that was actually abducted. Where Barney, you know. When you get into their field, if you look at Taken, they had a problem with that spaceship that they captured in Taken. Those of you, the people go in there, but they would die of radiation poisoning at a certain point. Well, that's a true story. And what happened was Barney Hill and Betty Hill, they were abducted and had the missing time and all of that. The book, I think, is called
Interrupted Journey.
Exactly. But Barney got enough, you know, you can put radiation into your body. And some people can handle it because radiation does the same thing as junk food. Nitrates do it, creates free radicals. But now, does the free radical, does your body disseminate the free radical, or does it cause it to, you know, create a cancer?
Right.
So with Betty, no problem. She had a higher, stronger immune system. Barney took him down, you know. And I've seen this too many times with contactees, abductees, depending on their immune system, which is your consciousness.
She's sickly now, though, I hear.
Huh?
She's pretty sick now.
Look how old she is.
Yeah. I don't know if she has I don't know if she has a disease or if it's just because of age.
Yeah. Well, I was always suspective of being around the ship, especially the Pleiadians. You know, I probably could have spent more time around them, but I was always cautious. But but luckily as a kid, I was around radiation at the Randolph Lab. We worked with cyclotrons and synchrotrons. I was around radiation a lot, and I found out by experience, and back then we didn't really know. It's like during the Manhattan Project, the project before mine, we really found out what radiation does when those guys were handling thorium and dying from it. You know, it's like, don't touch that stuff.
Yeah.
And they were glowing in the dark. Well, my generation was the next one after the Manhattan Project. And I remember getting so dosed with radiation that I went home to my house in Ann Arbor. My stepfather was there, and he actually broke out in hives because he got a contact high off of me. That is an unfathomable true story. I was dosed, but luckily, I had one of those immune systems that just didn't succumb to the effects of radiation. It's amazing. But the grays, no, they're bad.
So how did you get involved with the Pleiadians?
I got involved with them in 71. And the way I got involved with them, I was studying with a Rajput prince. The Rajput prince, if you study Alice Bailey and Madame Blavatsky, there was these guys called Rajput princes, and they would come to America from India, and they have a diplomatic pass, and they could shoot somebody, they would deport it. I mean, a real Rajput, identified by our government as such.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had one of them as a teacher, and he began to teach me about friendly extraterrestrials, and primarily a group called the Rishi. And the Rishis were the teachers of the Brahmins, and in Tibet, the Sanskrit language is about 26,000-28,000 years old. It was brought here from the Pleiades by a group called the Rishis, along with sound instruments that activated chakras, which we would classify one of those as sitar. Sitar would be one of those wave mechanisms.
Right.
Yeah. So that activates consciousness. So I kind of got primed for it. And so what happened was, I set up a meditation group, and I used to teach Kundalini yoga when I was younger, in another house over here in Laguna. Well, what happened was, I had this group set up, and the whole group started having the same image of this Pleiadian thing. We didn't know it was a Pleiadian thing. We just saw a female in some kind of a saucer. And then one night in 71, it was in the spring of April, the spaceship came down, was hovering behind my house in Laguna Beach on Nestal Road, 2096, I forget the address. And it was really strange, too, because that particular street, Nestal Road, back in the 30s, when Laguna was like dirt roads up here, George Dembski lived on that same hill.
No, that's coincidental, but there are no coincidences.
Yeah, exactly, no kidding. I mean, and so, within 300 feet where I lived on, I think it was 3096 Nestal Road, was a previous house where he lived. You know, my neighborhood, of course, built up.
Yeah.
And the ship came, and there she was. You know, she was hovering out there, and the door opened, and I saw her. And then we had a telepathic communication, and she said she'd be back later. And they couldn't be there now because the dogs were barking all over the damn place. The porch lights were going on, and 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was really funny because half the meditation group that I was with, I said there's something going to go on in the backyard. Because there was a big backyard with a big cliff and thousands of acres behind that, but we were up 1,000 feet above everything. So you look down across the hillside and the valleys. Where now it's not like that, but then it was wide open. This is 1971 in Laguna Beach. Now it's like huge down here with population. And so that's how it started, you know. And then the contact went on. And at that time, I hadn't even started Paradigm yet. I was still just left NASA, as a matter of fact. And this was like spacing me out, like, what is this? And then when I started Paradigm, I started traveling around the country in a motorhome, and I'd have these contacts all over in the deserts. I had one up at near Roswell where I was given. They started giving me designs of things. I didn't really know what I was getting, but you know, they gave me the design for a device we make called the radiator, and we built one of those things, and we had it tested by psychics and dowsers, and they said this does this and this. And I said thank you, because I didn't know what I was doing at the beginning. I know now, but because you know, it's many years of experience. It's cut me 29 years old.
Have I seen an old picture of you with one of these devices aiming it up into the heavens? Was that you?
Probably. You know, we made a thing called a fire star, and Eric Von Daniken used to take those things down to Mallorca, the island down there, and have do contact sessions. And, yeah, we developed so many things that went everywhere, all over the world, you know. I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, gosh, when the KGB... Well, one of my friends from the One World family, Joseph Amatry, went on Radio Moscow back when the Cold War, you know, war was up. This is 1978, wearing one of my power domes, which is a pyramid you wear on your head made out of titanium.
You wear a pyramid on your head?
Yeah. Yeah, I had those. You haven't ever seen them? I invented them back in the mid-70s.
Actually, I had a friend of mine who would wear one to school.
Yeah. We had them all over the world. Well, we had them tested. I mean, you can do all kinds of tests, physical tests, and you can see all kinds of changes in the human body. They detoxify the brain. I've got testimonies from the Orca Union School System up at San Luis Obispo. This one kid, stand arms, had grand mal seizures, he started wearing the pyramid, doesn't get them anymore, because the pyramid allows your body to heal, because there's instruction. He was taking lithium like they always give him on grand mal seizures, and we put the pyramid on, no more grand mal seizures.
Well, what is it about the pyramid shape that does that, Fred?
We'll have to continue that next week. Hold that question. What is it about the pyramid shape that does that? So this is Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show, and we'll continue on next week.